Hey folks, thanks for tuning into Off Camera. Before we get started, I want to remind you that if you haven't yet checked out offcamera.com, you are missing a whole wider world of this show, including full-length TV episodes, our app, and our limited edition off-camera print magazine. So take a moment after the show and check out the site and subscribe so you can get the latest off-camera news. Also, if you haven't yet, mosey on over to iTunes and give us a rating. 5 stars is completely acceptable. Also, if you want to comment about the show or suggest a guest or just say hi, send me an email at sam@offcamera.com. I love hearing from listeners, and it's a great way to continue this conversation outside of the episodes. And lastly, thank you for listening to this show. I hope you have as much fun listening as I do making it. And spread the word. Tell people about Off Camera, because we don't have an advertising budget. We don't have a marketing department. We just have you. And we want to make this show for as long as possible. And now, let's get to the main event, shall we? Enjoy the show. Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with actor, writer, and comic Thomas Middleditch. In elementary school, Thomas Middleditch thought he was a pretty fun guy to be around. Well, his classmates quickly set him straight. He was just weird. In setting him straight, they also set him on his artistic path, first through theater and then into the trenches of improv, stand-up, and sketch comedy. It wasn't a steady path. Chicago knocked him down a few notches, but McDonald's was loving it. He impatiently hopped cities and jobs in hopes of making things happen, which is why he found himself in the middle of the ocean when Saturday Night Live announced auditions at the theater he'd just left. I'll let Thomas fill you in on how he got from there to being the star of HBO's hit series Silicon Valley. It's a journey filled with both arrogance and humiliation, and one that leaves you unsure whether to laugh at him or give him a hug. But when you think about it, isn't that the way we feel about all truly funny people? As Thomas reflects on his not-so-funny childhood, his roundabout career path, and the transition from live comedy to serial TV, you'll be totally entertained. And if Nelson, British Columbia ever comes up as a Jeopardy category, you will totally cash in. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hey, Thomas, how you doing?
Hello, Sam. I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Is it cold now?
I thought that would be a really hilarious thing to pretend that you're cold.
Yeah.
You know, it's like one of the best bits in comedy.
It is. It's one that's tried and tested.
Yeah. Pretend that you're cold.
No, I wanted to have you on here because I love Silicon Valley, and like probably a lot of people, that's where I first discovered you. And and then through doing this research process, I get to like dig deep into where you've come. And it's been fascinating. It's like, it's kind of amazing. So I want to talk about all that. But the first thing I discovered that I didn't know is that you're from Canada.
Coinadoy.
Nelson, British Columbia.
Nelson,
right?
British Columbia, yeah. It's a kind of a mountain hippie town.
Right. And they filmed Roxanne there, right?
They did. They shot Roxanne there. Steve Martin is Cyrano de Balzac.
And yes.
old Long Nose Magoo.
Well, I think it started as a silver mining town.
Yes, it started out as some mining expedition, and then it kind of was that for years. Whatever mines kind of dried up, and it was just kind of like this nothing ex mining town until, legend has it, during like the 60s and stuff, American draft dodgers came up and like hippieized it.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I read in the 80s that there was like this big economic downturn when like industry went out, and that's when the town decided to redo Baker Street.
I'm sure it wasn't like an overnight thing
right.
the hippie influx, but yeah, I mean, look, as far as I know it, it is hemp, patchouli, artisan handcrafts.
Yeah, isn't it like voted Canada's best small art scene?
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of art, a lot of pot. It's like per capita, very gay and lesbian friendly.
Really?
Yeah, it's white bread as fuck though.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 92% white.
Jewish was exotic where I come from.
Really?
So yeah, I remember when I first got to Chicago and like that was I was like, oh wow, American, like African Americans and the culture and like the yo 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 and whatever. I was like, I don't. I mean, even as I'm explaining it, it sounds like
you feel awkward
I'm
just
so
explaining it.
White. I couldn't be whiter. And the yo yo yo, and the what's up dog. I couldn't get it.
I love that there's a Jewish accent to the what's up dog.
Yo yo yos and the what's ups. Idle doidle.
Would it be odd if I just researched Nelson for this whole thing and not you at all?
Yeah, no,
I
would
talk
love
about
to talk
per
about
capita.
Nelson. We used to do like heritage plays. Some of like my first acting gigs as a young thespian. Me and like the theater nerds of the town, we got like government grants to put on like plays about like we'd make a little stage in the park and be like, just over there was the Silverhead Mine and so and so got hung round this corner. Hello, I'm the mayor and what happened to you know, like all that stuff.
Do you have town pride?
Yeah, growing up I still do kinda. Although when I go back it's a bit of head shaking. It's just it's very earnest. But I love it. I mean it's like Nelson's great.
What kind of kid were you? Do you have a big imagination? Were you like
Yeah, definitely. I was alone a lot. I mean, my brother was a lot older, and I was pretty sensitive. I was sensitive as a kid, so easily made fun of.
Yeah.
Is definitely an accurate description. It wouldn't take me a lot to get riled up, and then I'd be in tears. And so, like, you know, certain kids would love that. I mean, they, you know, certain kids love making other kids cry.
Yeah.
So I was the recipient of that a fair amount. So I, you know, spent a lot of time alone and like, you know, playing with action figures and whatever else. And I was kind of like pretty shy growing up. Like I have memories of like being in social gatherings and literally clinging to my mom's dress in the sense that like I was just like burrowing my head in there.
Really?
As like conversations happened around. And then I would have these moments of being silly, like whenever I do impressions of my dad, they're British, and my dad, one of his quotes is always like, oh, put on a proper smile, Tom, because he's trying to take a family photo, and I'm like, ooh, you know. But then other than that, I'd be kind of like a little bit shy.
If you look back at yourself as a kid, does it make sense that you're sitting here and that you're acting?
No.
And
I don't think so at all. I mean, like, I think the odds of getting out of coming from Nelson. Well, I don't know. I look at Nelson as being pretty fortunate. Like you could have been born in a small town in Canada, and I happen to be born in like the artsy one,
right,
with a theater
right.
scene. You know, but even then, that's like up in the mountains. But I look at the route that had to happen. All the little things, you know, get involved in theater, try and do theater one way, realize that's not the thing, finding comedy, Toronto, Chicago, New York, LA. I mean, it's like, it's a lot of things that lined up. I get kids, even from my hometown, or even just like people that I met in passing from Canada or elsewhere, like, how do you get there? And it's like, dude, there's no algorithm. There's no like math
right,
to it. You
right.
just take what's in front of you and like.
But I don't know. I spent a lot of time by myself, too. I was really little, and there was 2 years where there was a kid.
Look at you now, 6'3", 6'4"?
6'7".
6'7"?
Yeah.
My goodness.
No, but I was really little. I matured really late, and there was a bully on our street named Sean Miller that just terrorized me for a few years.
Oh, my bully was also my friend. So Darren Lindsay lived down my street as well. And I kind of, like, loved him because he was, like, outgoing and fun, and not in a gay way, man, but in a, it suddenly gets like really weird.
Darren Lindsay,
not
I that, love you.
That gay shit. No, I totally loved him, and I wanted to be friends with him so bad, and occasionally be really nice to me, and we would go play and like make spears.
When no other friends were around, he would.
And then he would just turn on me, and I remember one specific day, we were all playing, and then his friend, this guy, Jordy King, Jordy, we were all three of us together and we're playing G.I. Joes and whatever, and then they suddenly just started picking on me. My last name, Middle Ditch, some
doesn't
might
take
say
a high
Little
IQ
Bitch, right?
To,
turn that around, that used to get me. It used to get my brother too, but in seventh grade he broke a kid's nose and that was that, but not me. I never did that stuff.
Wait, your brother did the exact thing that everyone tells you you're supposed to do.
Yeah,
but
fight,
none of us
fought
do
and
it.
Stood up for himself, and it worked. Then again, I don't know if it did work because he fought all the time. So it's like maybe you get a reputation as like a fighter, and now you like have to constantly fight.
Right, right. They're like, oh, he thinks he's so tough.
Yeah, yeah, I'll get him, you know. Out of the way, boys. Let me have a crack. That kind of crud. But anyway, they started picking on me in tears, like slamming on the door. I got like so, it was a really traumatic event. I was trying to make them stop. I was like first pleading with them and then trying to fight them. And you know, he's so much bigger than me, throwing me around. It was terrible. And then I remember at like, we were 18 at the time, just graduating, and we still sometimes took the same bus.
This was years later.
Yeah, I'm sitting with this Darren Lindsay. I was like, hey man, do you remember that one time, you know, back when we were kids and Jordy and all that kind of stuff? And he's like, oh yeah. And I was like, that sucked, you know, I still remember it. And he's like, oh, don't worry about it. Jordy came up to me and said, hey, do you want to make fun of Tom? And I said, yeah. And I was like, huh? You mean there really was no reason? You just arbitrarily decided to ruin my life at that point? I just think that shit is so weird, like how bullies, well, I guess it's just kids, you know?
Well, it's funny because when you're the one being picked on, I think that it's such a bigger experience. Like, I remember, like, I would alter my path home from school.
Yeah.
You know?
Because it's emotionally devastating. Someone's just cruel to you, and you're like, why? I've done nothing. I'm just me, and maybe I'm weird, or maybe I'm not. They're just like, I'm going to be cruel.
Yeah.
It's like, that's so sinister. It's like magnifying glass to ants kind of thing. Like, just like, because I can.
Yeah.
You'll burn.
No, and I think that when that stuff happens, I mean, obviously kids go all different ways with that. It could be like your brother and start fighting, or you.
Yeah.
But how did it affect you?
It definitely wasn't fun. And that, you know, and sadly, that wasn't like the only time where something like that happened, either with that kid or some other kids. You know, but I don't think. I think I haven't seen a lot of kids, right? You're either on the recipient, receiving end, the giving end, or somehow you're like so anonymous that no one even pays attention to you in that whole sort of bully to be bullied or not bullied kind of thing. But I guess that manifested itself, and like I would still try and be weird, but I mean, I look back on like elementary school and like a bit of junior high. I spent most lunches by myself.
You did?
Walking around, talking to myself. It's been a weirdo, you know, because like no one would hang out with me.
Did it make you be interior, like?
Of course. I think. Well, look, maybe a little darker now. It's like I think, and this happened. I still feel this. That made me into kind of a really secret sad guy. Like, I think comedy is the outlet, it's a way of dealing with it. It's a way of like looking at me like how absurd all of this is, life, whatever.
Yeah,
let's make fun of it. But the sadness, I mean, it's like, especially when the hormones hit and teenage years happen, I feel like I'm still living my life with like a secret like 14-year-old boy, like black hair, just like so sad listening to Elliott Smith. My favorite singer, my favorite musical artist, Elliott Smith, still listen to him almost daily. There's just part of that, you know, that just is like that. That's always going to be part of me. Like, I feel like back then, you're wondering. You're like, what is it? Like, why am I like this? Or maybe just resigning to it. Like, I guess this is me. You know, it's like that's teenage drama.
I sit at that table. Yeah.
You know, like fuck my life. Hashtag FML. Right, with the kids. But yeah, it's that sort of like teen turmoil that is like, woe is me, the world fucking doesn't understand. And I definitely felt like, I mean, I know I'm not alone in this. Like, as soon as you become an adult, that's when you start seeing your parents as humans, because up until that point, they were just like these representatives of like people who don't get you. That's how it was for me.
Would you try to tell them, like, no, you...
It's how's school today, Tom? Fine.
Fine. I know, why?
And even when I'm like class clown kid and like making everybody laugh and like I'm at school being totally extroverted and being crazy, I get home and be like, fine, I'll be on the computer playing
Why?
Video games. I don't know.
Isn't that funny?
I find when I go back to home to Nelson, I find pressure and I actually have to shake it off to revert to what everyone thinks of me, you know, like to be the self that you were minus the whatever it's been, 12, 14, 15 years of growth.
Yeah.
That you've become your own man and decided, no, this is kind of like what I want to be. These are my friends. This is my tribe, you know. And you go back hometown, I kind of feel this weird secret pressure to be, I don't know, what everyone used to perceive me as. And it's weird. It's weird. It's such a...
Like, if you were home for 3 weeks, would all this seem like a dream?
Yeah, well, I'd first be pulling out my hair. I've done almost that. I mean, I kind of... It sounds like I'm shitting on Milton. I think it's a very special place, but I just think you get into a town where... You get into a place where it's like people from your past that aren't necessarily like the people you really, on a day-to-day level now, spend time with.
Yeah.
This is kind of like age-old stuff. Like, people go home for the holidays or whatever, and it's like... They fight with their family because everybody's different now, but everyone's still trying to be the same to each other. Like, your dad's, in your mind, it feels like your dad still thinks of you as like a 60-year-old boy, and you're like, I'm a grown man, father.
Right.
But even then, you should give him the credit for being a grown-ass man and having a whole life before you even got there.
Well, maybe if you don't call him father.
I do like to call him father.
You do?
What, am I going to call him Mike?
Well, yeah, dad.
So strange.
Father sounds like you're in a version of The Sound of Music.
No, father and mother. Mother dearest. And father figure. He's not.
Well, when I think of it, I think like some of the most interesting kids that I knew or that grew up to be interesting, they did spend a lot of time alone. It made me wonder, like, did you discover comedy being alone, or how did you discover you were funny or you like to make people laugh?
In like junior high school, Kids in the Hall was me. That's all I wanted to be. It's what got me into comedy. When I graduated high school, I was like, my goal is to find some people that to do sketch comedy with. That was my goal.
Was part of that when you found other kids that liked that, that was the first time you could be yourself and feel comfortable?
Oh,
and not...
yeah, and also just be silly and weird and not have anyone go, you're weird. That was kryptonite to me as a kid. It's like someone just be like, you're weird. I hated that.
And then you would go into your shell.
Yeah, that's like just, you know, it's like, oh, I'm weird? Oh, I thought it was like fun. I thought it was a fun guy to be around. No, I'm weird. I don't know. It sounds so tame now because now I'm like, if someone called me weird, I'd be like, thanks. What are you, normal? That sucks.
Yeah.
But as a kid, you like want acceptance and like weird is anything but. And as adolescence especially, it's like school is life. And so it's hard to think of what life will be after that. It's hard to think of like moving from a small town or wherever you live to like another place and meeting a whole new set of people and starting your whole thing and deciding what you want to do as opposed to being forced to go into like a little institution and being like bombarded.
Right.
Like, you get to have a choice. And so if you don't like someone, you can be like, I choose not to be around you ever again. And that works, you know? Whereas in school...
You're stuck.
That's it, man. You're putting a min pin and a Rottweiler in together, and the min pin's just like, fucking hell, not today.
Why does the min pin have an accent?
I don't know. I don't know. He just did. This miniature picture's from England for some reason. Shipped over. Oh, got stuck in Nelson. Fuck. Shit.
Well, okay, so was there a revelation at some point where you're like, hey, I'm actually kind of good at this? Like, I'm quick, or I'm... Like, do you remember when it became something where...
That play. I mean, the arrogance of youth is... I did that play. It's called I'm a Fool. It's like a play that you give schools. And
okay.
Like, it's okay. It's not a known play. There's bits and stuff that...
Wasn't Hamlet.
No. I, like, spat so enthusiastically. No, it was... And me and the drama teacher were at some, like, physical comedy routine where I see the audience, woo, crack up. And, like... The crowd of enthusiastic like ninth graders, of course, are gonna go like, yeah, you know, they're gonna go crazy, even if it's pretty hack. But I think it was Pete Holmes says you need a little bit of like delusion in order to make it in this business. Like, there's something to be said for like totally fucking kidding yourself, because especially in those early years where you're like against all odds, you're like looking up at the Game of Thrones white wall being like, how am I going to cross that? you need to think that you're like kind of like the best around,
yeah,
and that you deserve a shot and you're going to make it. It's only a matter of time.
And there's not tens of thousands of people doing it at the same time.
Yeah. And that, you know, the slow realization that at every casting call you like go in and like, oh, there's like 80 people that look like me. You have to think that you're going to kind of be the guy. Now, that manifests itself into you being a straight-up dick. And I even had a one point in, when I was learning improv in Chicago, one of my, like, improv coaches sat me down and was like, you know, she gave me this big story about how she could have been on SNL, but, like, she had a reputation for being a real tough person to work with. And, you know, and she just sort of, like, hinted at the fact that, like, you know, being an asshole doesn't get you that far. And I really had, like, I was like, oh, introspective moment.
That's so interesting that someone would care enough to.
Yeah. I took it as, at first I was like, fuck this bitch. And then I was like, oh, that's probably a good sign of your arrogance. And then I kind of, like, tried to get and from that point on, my whole shift changed of, like, I don't know, humility and recognizing, like, oh, you maybe not the shit. You're maybe not like the best person to walk the earth. Because honestly, at that point, I was like, why aren't I on SNL right now? I moved to Chicago. I should have been on a main stage in like 6 months and then SNL in like three. But
you had the delusion.
Yeah.
Which you needed.
But it got me to there.
So let me back up just a sec. So, because I'm curious about, like, once you started performing, how did that change your situation at school?
It was like, it became like Tom the weirdo to like Tom the actor. Honestly, within a year, I was friends with all the kids that used to make fun of me.
Really?
And I was going to their birthday parties, and they were coming to mine, and we were all doing sleepovers, and I was having the best time watching action movies and all that kind of shit. And we're friends. Nerf wars, all that stuff. All that, like,
And you
shit.
Did that thing where it's like, you just forgave them all immediately.
Of course. Acceptance? Are you kidding me? When you're in eighth or ninth grade, that's, like, all you desire. Yeah, acceptance. I didn't care about girls. I was so obsessed with girls. Girls, oh my God, always. But I couldn't, I never dated anyone in high school because I didn't want to jeopardize my, like, what I thought is my precarious social standing.
Really?
So crazy shit.
Wait a minute, so you thought whatever you'd achieved,
if I decide
it was
on
such
someone,
a delicate
then it,
balance?
Then it puts me in something, because I was, by the end of high school, for example, I was friends with everyone, kind of. Like, all the little groups and cliques, I was trying to be approachable. Still spent a lot of my lunches alone because the groups and stuff would go off and be their own thing. And me, the guy who's, like, friends with everyone, it's just, like, again, walking around.
Talking to himself.
Yeah, talking to himself, going up to the guys who are playing hacky sack, and be like, can I play, please? Will you let me? Yeah.
So you leave school.
That's funny.
You don't go to... Because I read you dropped out of school or something like that.
Yeah, I went to, you know, because you go to your, like, you're in a small town, you go to your guidance counselor, right?
Right.
And you're like, so I want to do comedy. I want to be an actor. What do I do? And they're like, oh, I guess you, I didn't say I want to be an actor. I said, I want to do comedy. This is what I want to do. And he's like, oh, I guess you go to theater school and get a degree. So I was like, oh, okay. I got to trust Mr. Whoever. So then I went to University of Victoria. Which is, like, in terms of, like, colleges that have a theater program, that's pretty good.
Okay.
But it's not, like, a conservatory, like, hoity-toity thing. It's not Juilliard. But went there for a couple years and did pretty well. Like, by my second year, I was, like, the lead of all of a bunch of plays, and, like, that was usually reserved for, like, the fourth year, like, the seniors and stuff.
Hence the arrogance grows.
Yeah, of course. Now I'm like, this fucking bullshit. God, they should be paying me. And then, so I actually drop out of there to go to a hoity-toity theater acting school in Toronto. But the summer between being accepted and starting, I met all these people that are doing comedy. They're doing sketch, stand-up, improv, all this kind of stuff. I was like, oh, wait, you can just do it? You don't have to go to school? I don't have to come up with my classical and contemporary monologues,
right?
You know, and talk like this, you know, so the people in the back row can hear me, you know, all that hellish, like, oh, the theater, the boards, all that shit. I don't have to do that. Sign me up. And so I blew theater school off and, like, started doing that stuff.
And how was that conversation with your parents at that point?
Honestly, I gotta do hats off to them. They're pretty cool. I'm sure they hung up the phone and were like, ooh. But they were like, well, we made a promise that we would pay, you know, 4 years of your post-secondary education. So just know that if you want help with this financially, if you just living in an apartment in Toronto doing that stuff, that's going to eat out of your college fund. I was like, I'm fine with that. Thank you. Thankfully, it's paying off. But
yeah.
It took a while.
So did you just assume that you, with all of this arrogance, that you would just be accepted into the Saturday Night Live cast?
Honestly, I thought I was like, oh, cool. You know, I know Eddie Murphy was like the youngest cast member or whatever. Maybe it was Adam Chandler or whoever it was. But I was like, I'll be like the second or third youngest. You know, like, I just like thought that. I thought all it's going to take is as soon as I'm done the Second City course, I'll get on main stage, and then like a year later, Lorne Michaels will come and like want to get me. But if I think about it, it's not too far off. I spent about three and a half years in Chicago. I never got on main stage. In fact, I thought that Second City, bless them, I like them, but like they're very institutionalized. There's a lot of waiting to be done. Like if you want a main stage, you got to be waiting there for like 8 years.
Oh wow.
So. Like, maybe, you know, there's obviously examples that prove either way, longer, shorter. Like, it takes a while. But I was getting up. I managed, you know, Chicago's great because you get a lot of stage time. And, you know, it's kind of like that mid-level training ground area. So if you're good, you kind of you rise above. It's easier to rise above there. And so I remember I was kind of like, actually, Chicago was when I kind of got humility. That's where I started to get doubt. That's where I started to be like, what am I doing here? Because I'm sitting there like walking dogs for peanuts. And like, I felt like I had achieved essentially a fair amount to do in this sort of improv world. Like I'm performing on all the shows I want to do. What am I going to do here? What's my life going to be here? I was actually contemplating coming back to Canada and like, I don't know, graphic design. Something like that.
You were.
Something totally different.
So you thought it's not happening fast enough?
Or whatever it was, like just lamenting the kind of difficult situation it was. And then I took a job with Second City because they had a deal with Norwegian Cruise Lines.
Okay.
They still do. They're like one of the main entertainment acts on Norwegian Cruise Lines. On any of the big NCL boats, you'll see a Second City show. And they cast out of everywhere.
Okay.
And I did that, and I was like, okay, cool, 4 months at sea, I can handle that. It'll give me a chance to really decide like what I want to do with my life. And then within the first like week of me being on this boat, the news dropped that like Lorne Michaels and Seth Meyers and all these people are coming to Chicago to like audition people to be on the show. And I'm like, I'm on the ship, are you kidding me? And I knew I would be on
and
that
showcase. And you're out at sea.
I would be on that showcase 100%, and I made such a stink. I was such a little bitch, little whiny bitch, emailing, calling, being just like a brat, and they agreed to let me buy a ticket from, so one of the stops was Bermuda, so I got off of the ship at Bermuda, got an airplane, flew to Chicago, did the showcase, flew back to New York to meet the ship, and then like landed, you know, taxi, go, 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 and then like just get on the ship in time.
Really?
Yeah, and then it turned out like, Seth Meyers really liked it. They met with me. I tested for SNL. Didn't get it, obviously. But
so you auditioned?
Yeah.
So what was your audition like? What did you prepare?
It was three characters, three impressions. I can't remember all of them. I remember that it was pretty nerve wracking because like especially at that time, you know, SNL is like comedy gold.
Yeah.
You know, it's really you're nervous, and people tell you like, okay, so don't. They're probably not going to laugh, so don't be disheartened. And you're like, okay, and then you see people come out and they've got like a bunch of like character pieces on, and they're just like, you know. And
where are you standing and waiting when these people are coming out?
Well, you'll only see like the first maybe like the like one or two people that just came before you, because up until then they give you one of the cast members' dressing rooms, so you get to like sit there by yourself. But I was
just
fortunate,
for the anxiety to rise,
just to be like, yeah, exactly. And you sit there for a while, and I felt good because I had like a private meeting with Seth and Mike Schumacher, who was a producer at the time, and we kind of like, they were like, look, we're gunning for you. And I was like, great, this is great. So I felt confident, and I went in, and right away people laughed. Like I started doing this, I think my first character was like this kid, this 10-year-old boy, he's doing stand-up, but all his stand-up jokes are like how he tricks his dad and doesn't eat all his peas. He just spreads it around on the plate.
I saw this. I saw.
Yeah, there's that shit's online, I think, right?
Yeah. Where you got like a Converse shirt on and glasses and a helmet.
Yeah, that was one of my SNL characters.
Okay, all right.
And I think even that, there's another clip of what's supposed to be that guy's
you
dad.
You playing his dad with the mustache.
Yeah. That all, I think that was also another character. And then I did dumb impressions. I did like Chris Martin from Coldplay, just, you know, and I talked about.
I have to see that.
It's not very good. Like in hindsight, all these things are so dumb. He's just like, oh, I'm Chris Martin from Coldplay. Only because I get told I look like him. But it was something about, like, because he's an activist for something. Something about, oh, leaves. Leaves every year, millions of leaves fall from their trees and die during autumn. And it's like he's campaigning to not
save
have leaves change color and die. It was dumb. It was dumb. And then I did, like, here's my impression of Seth Meyers. Thank you very much. You know, like, that, you know, stupid stuff, because we always get told.
You look alike. Yeah.
And it went really well. The audition ended, and, like, I think one of the producers called me up and said, hey, man, that went well. So just stay by your phone, you know, like, it's looking good. And it didn't happen. But it's okay. That's what happens. I think I looked similar to Seth. They kind of had my type already on the show at that time, so. That's how
I mean, you just like blew over that so quick, but was it a giant disappointment?
Oh, fuck yeah.
I was like, you're just like, oh, it's fine, moving on.
SNL! I mean, yeah, of course, at the time I thought it was like, I mean, it you get to have, especially when you're like mid-20s, you now have the coolest job in a very cool city. You're a fucking god. I mean, like, in the industry of entertainment, you don't get paid that much. It's kind of a brutal contract because they sign you on for like 8 years.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a tough one, but you don't care at that point. You're like, you beat everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody wanted that thing. You won.
And to get that close.
I think in hindsight, I wear it as like, hey, you got that close. But I mean, at that time, I was like pretty sad. But I was fortunate because this is all, by the way, I auditioned while I was still working on the cruise ship. So like I like landed at another place.
So were
place.
You sitting by a ship to shore phone?
No, I was waiting for email to kick in. Like, got a signal. What? Nothing. Okay, fair. But I kind of flew from NASA, which was one of the stops. Went to New York, auditioned, had all my little prop pieces and stuff. And then since I was there for a couple extra days, this new agency that I just got. It's so weird. I went on a cruise ship. Suddenly I dropped my agent, manager, got new ones, tested for SNL. Like, it's like, oh, sure. Be on some isolated thing for 4 months and everything, your whole world changes. So I got these just general meetings with like casting directors from like ABC, NBC, and CBS. And because all I had was a bag and like that helmet, you know, attached to it, I'd bring that to the thing. Because I knew after these meetings I'd be walking onto the cruise ship. And they were like, what's the helmet? Did you skateboard here? I was like, no, I just tested for SNL. I felt confident. I was like, it was good. You want to? I'll do my audition for you. And I would never do that now. I don't know what was going on in my head, but I was like just offering to show people because I felt so good. Because in my mind I was
I'll let you in on it.
Yeah. Yeah, like, I'm so baller right
Lauren
now.
Lauren told me to keep this under wraps, but I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah, but here you go. And so I was doing this, like, oh, God, it's so strange. Like, so they'd be like, oh, yeah, sure. Click, put it on the camera, watch this thing. And it went, I mean, it was actually fun. And so I didn't get an SNL, but ABC gave me what they call, like, a holding deal. Sort of, I guess I explained for the audience. Like, a holding deal is essentially they pay money to call dibs on you. So during pilot season, you only audition for their stuff. And so while I didn't get SNL, the cruise ship ended, and I was like, well, I got this holding deal. Great, I'll move to New York. Another breadcrumb to keep me on the trail of like not moving to Canada.
I always think about timing because it seems to me like you were born at the perfect time generationally to be the first generation of people who also had the opportunity to make things on their own.
Yes.
And put them out there. Like there, oh, yeah. Previous to you, there wasn't the ability to go out and make a sketch, film it yourself, and put it out there. And I feel like your time coincided exactly with the rise of like Funny or Die and,
yes,
and things like that.
100%. That's why I got the new reps and stuff like that, because it just so happened. Happenstance is a lot of this stuff. It just so happened, me, TJ Miller,
yeah,
And this guy, Jordan Boat Roberts, he's a director. He just directed Skull Island, the new King Kong huge movie, after doing his like little indie at Sundance, $250 million movie.
He's probably arrogant.
Yeah, he kind of is, but he would tell you that himself. he's awesome, though. I love him. But anyway, we would stay up until 5 in the morning making little shorts, and we just had a few of them online and stuff.
Right. I mean, it is interesting because it seems like you wouldn't have to sit around and wait for the phone to ring. You could just...
You have to be proactive.
Go make stuff. I mean, tell me, I think, obviously a lot of people know this, but I think it's worthy to hear it from you, the Chicken McNugget story, because that's sort of one of those things where you make something in half a day and it ends up becoming...
Like, yeah, a thing.
Yeah.
That all is around the same time as the cruise ship, so the Chicken McNuggets thing is...
So what happened there?
I would like to have a disclaimer. I don't condone McDonald's. I think they're kind of like a bad news people.
Yeah, I'm with you on
terrible
that.
To animals and thus the environment. So, but that aside, at the time, I didn't give a shit. I hadn't reached my zenith.
There goes
of,
our
like,
McDonald's sponsorship.
Environmental, like, dickhead, like calling foul on everything. But at the time, I was just... It was actually meant to kind of make fun of McDonald's because at the time they were doing, that was the whole ba-da-da-da-da, I'm loving it.
Right, right.
And them like being like, check it out, we're like casually urban or like white urban. Like, haha, yo, hey man, we just got playing basketball. Let's go grab a Big Mac. Cool. Da-da-da-da-da. Like all that shit. I hated it. I was like, I see through your corporate bullshit. You're like appeal to the masses like hell. And so me and my friend Fernando, for our Second City like class showcase, we just did. I think that was at Spawn, but it ended up being like this little rap about McNuggets. But we kind of were like making fun of it. Was always like McNuggets, what? And then that ended up being like a 30-second bit. And so like in the show, we just did it. And then the teacher director of that show was like, you should film that and just put it online. And I was like, okay. And just so happens it was 30 seconds. Then that became viral. And then McDonald's ended up buying it. Which I mean, it was featured in like a viral marketing book made by advertisers of like, how do things become viral? Because this is still when people are trying to figure it out.
So you get the call one day and someone's like, we're McDonald's and we want to buy this from you.
Yeah. It was through some, I mean, I got a call from like my agent who wasn't, not the good one. But we got it, yeah. It had been on for like a year at that time, just on the internet. So at that time, I was like, I'll take any money at this point.
Yeah.
But what was weird is like, that thing, it had been bought, and then we went on the cruise ship. And I remember, so like when you're working on these cruise ships, right, they're like 4,000 passengers on these things. It's massive. And before your show, you're just an anonymous guy. You're just a person on the boat. You may have your like name tag or something if you want to put it on, but like just you don't have to wear a uniform. You're just a guy.
You don't have to wear anything.
Yeah. The only rules are like you just can't get caught, you know, doing drugs and like taking passengers to your room or going into their room and stuff like that. But there are ways around it.
Which we'll
is like, so scandalous. I know, I'm sure.
We're taking off camera on a cruise ship.
Yeah.
Now
any
it's settled.
NCL representative is like, doesn't happen, like public statement, he's a liar. Hide your daughters, passengers.
Second City is coming.
Yeah, Second City's coming to take them. so you're kind of anonymous. And then you do a show, and the theater that's on these boats is like 2,000 seats or whatever. So essentially, after two shows, the entire boat knows who you are. And
so now you're famous in your little
ecosystem. Suddenly, overnight, you become famous, right? Everyone's like, oh, Second City. And we poured it out in New York and going to like Bahamas and stuff over the summer. So it's a lot of like Jersey, Bronx, working classes where I first saw my first Guidos with a haircut. And like, yo, bro, it's like Jersey Shore, real deal shit. Like teenagers getting like caught on the teen disco, like fingering each other. Like really wild, terrible stuff. But they'd suddenly be like, hey, Second City, holy shit, it's the McNuggets guy. Because that commercial was airing at the time. So they get a double whammy. But it was great because they'd be like, McNuggets guy, let me buy you a shot. And so I just get shots fed to me at like 2 p.m.
God, it seems like if you didn't think about it too hard, you could just be like, this is a great level of fame. Every 2 weeks,
sure.
There's a new crowd of people.
Believe you me, I know plenty of people who have stuck with the Second City cruise ship program.
Really?
Yeah.
I've never been on a cruise ship, so I've never fingered anybody on a cruise
You've
ship.
You've never fingered anyone on a boat?
No.
Oh, you haven't lived.
I will cut all of that out, by the way.
Why? Why?
Because, you know, it's...
I've never met a girl once who didn't like getting fingered. So disgusting. What a disgusting thing to say. I feel like I need to say that, and it has to be known that I'm like a billionaire. The most offensive thing is, like, I'm a billionaire. I've got an exotic cat on my lap. There's, like, a very fancy walking cane that's leaned up against, like, a very nice sofa, nicer than this.
Yes, much nicer.
And I'm like, I've never met one girl in my whole life that doesn't enjoy being fingered. I mean, that would be a villain that you'd want to hate.
That would be viral, too. That would be... talk about...
Keep this in!
I know. All right. Fingering stays.
Fingering stays. Executive decision by the talent.
No, but I think that it's such an interesting thing. Like, you would never guess in the path of success that it would pass through a cruise ship like that. And it's kind of fascinating, no. You know?
I like all that stuff. I think, you know, I know a couple, actors here that have maybe just kind of got their success either early or just kind of in a very straightforward Hollywood way, like they did commercials, TV, and now they're who they are, whatever they are.
Right.
I feel really happy and fortunate that I took, personally, what I perceive to be a pretty roundabout way. I've had plenty of odd jobs to pay the bills, did, like, weird, shitty, like, tours of improv, like, at colleges or corporate events where no one's paying attention. I've done, like... I do this improvised Shakespeare show.
Yeah.
And I've done that at a cafeteria at a college where people are just trying to study and we're coming up in like tunics and rolled up pants being like, huzzah, hoo-hoo! And they're like, the fuck is going on? Just weird things, cruise ships. I like that. That's character building. I think all that stuff draws on, I mean, all the work now draws on that in some way. I think.
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. I think that a lot of people, if they had sort of a rough childhood or if they got bullied or picked on or whatever, it can shatter their confidence and send them on a certain path. And
yeah.
I think other people take that experience and use it almost as a challenge or they won't be felled by it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's interesting that you know, whatever you had inside you, whatever spirit you had inside you that was able to handle those awkward moments of being on stage in an improv situation. I mean, I don't know if those situations in elementary school help that and make you okay with bombing or if like...
I still hate it. Yeah. I'm not okay with bombing. Can't stand it.
But you're willing to get through it.
Sure,
it's not going to stop you. And I think that's so interesting.
Well, I feel... Oh, a couple things I just want to say. Like, well, I think I'll give hats off to my parents for instilling confidence. They weren't the type of people that were like, you can do anything. Like those kind of like, you're a butterfly that can conquer the world. But they were very supportive. And I think for them, when they tried to put me in all kinds of sports and this and that, and I was like, I don't know, and like not into anything.
They were worried that you wouldn't find your thing.
And right? Then when I found drama, my dad, as a result, was like one of the committee members on the local theater because
that's so
he
nice.
Wanted to stay connected and be all this kind of stuff. Like as a kid, I didn't appreciate that at all, but now I totally do. I'm like
right.
they were pretty supportive.
Right.
But that said, I mean, and then conversely, it's not as if I haven't had my moments, man, of like being like, what the hell am I doing?
Yeah.
Like only since Silicon Valley really have I kind of got some kind of comfort and being like, at least for now I feel really good. But I bet when the show ends, I'm gonna be like, what am I doing?
Well,
I've had
fine.
Moments where I've been like, I've called up my mom being like, I don't know, crying, going crazy. Like it's
really
it's a mental, I don't know. It's this business can be really kind of like, it can fuck with you. It can like destroy your confidence. It can kind of like make you reevaluate like what you even hold dear in your life.
I see that you work some of that into your characters too. Like, funny thing about Silicon Valley is that a lot of your sketch characters, like, it seems like you're very willing to create pretty unlikable people. I don't know. Does that
no,
make
that's,
any sense?
That's 100% true. I always like, I think characters need to have some kind of like internal sadness or strife. Like true funny characters also have like some terrible sadness to them or something going on wrong in their lives where they're just like not capable of dealing with it.
Yeah, no, I see that. And probably the best compliment I could give you about Silicon Valley is that the guy sitting here right now is so different than Richard Hendricks. And you're not, I mean, you're not doing any prosthetics, you're not doing any crazy clothes, you're not doing anything different. And yet, the person sitting in front of me is this confident, handsome, funny dude that's...
handsome.
Not that handsome.
But like pretty handsome.
Fairly handsome.
Yeah, like with this new mustache, right? It looks good.
Yes. Well, that and then that's another reason you don't look like him. But no, but I think that when you get introduced to an actor through a show, you don't have anything else to go by.
Of course.
It's like Kramer, right?
Yes.
On Seinfeld. And I would assume that 95% of the time you get recognized, it's from that show and people knowing the show. And I just wonder if you notice this phenomenon of people expecting you to be more like him.
Of course. And I love that. I love it when people are like, hey, you're not like Richard at all. Even if they mean it kind of in a way that like is disappointing, like they're disappointed somehow, I'm still like, that's great. I mean, of course I'm not. I'm like, I'm an actor. And I feel like a lot of actors kind of get that. They're like, oh, you're not so-and-so. But I'll choose to take that as a compliment, as an indication of my immense acting ability. But yeah, I mean, that's like, I remember during the process of it, the process of getting this show is kind of weird too.
Well, yeah, wasn't it written for you?
Yes, but I never believed it.
Even when you were told that, you didn't believe
it. I moved to LA from New York City because, you know, I wanted to make sure there was like something to come here to, and it was a very loose connection. I had pitched an animated show.
Okay.
And it looked like it was going to get made with MTV. And they, at the time, were bringing back Beavis and Butthead to MTV. And it just so happened that when I drew my little drawings for this little pitch that I made, I just was in a very Mike Judge mood, and they kind of looked like Mike Judge drawings. Unintentional, just sort of happened that way.
Okay.
So it all very fit. And so, great, we're working on the show. They might go together. I was like, great, okay. I've always thought of my, do voices. Animation's always been a dream of mine. I didn't think that was going to be my first thing, but here we go. That's going to be my life. I'll be like in animation.
So even this far into your career, you think like, I'll just become an animator.
Yeah. I was like, I've always done voices. I felt like it was a natural fit, but it never felt like, I always considered myself more of a performer, but there you go. Fine. I'll do animation. That sounds fun.
Just keep me away from Nelson.
Just keep me out of Nelson. Keep me away. Keep me away. But then my show didn't get picked up, but during the whole making of that, John and Dave were like, we're writing this show for HBO with Mike, and you know, it's about like tech, Silicon Valley people. We think you'd be so great for the lead. We're gonna write it with you in mind. And I was like, yeah, right. I mean, you hear that shit, and you're like, me? They're never gonna buy it. Like, HBO will never let that happen. And even like when the script that we're about
so
to
shoot. So arrogant guy is gone at this point.
Arrogant guy is destroyed. After like 2 years of being in New York City, crying and calling my parents, being like, I fucked up, I made the worst mistake. Arrogant guy is buried in the ground in an unmarked gravesite, nowhere to be found. And sure enough, like the show starts getting made, they're gonna make a pilot. Okay, I still have to audition for it. I wasn't expecting to be offered the part. But during that process, it was, you know, to talk about sort of like forming this character of Richard. It's not like I went up to Silicon Valley and like studied them. I just sort of got down to the base qualities of what this guy kind of was, his agitatedness, his nervousness, his like tunnel vision meticulousness. Because although I'm not a programmer in real life, I am kind of computer literate.
So when you did get the script, what did you first relate to about the character?
I thought it was funny. I was like, okay, cool. Like, he doesn't necessarily have the crazy lines. He doesn't have the big jokey things. So I'm going to find these little moments. I'm going to find looks, reactions, maybe a physical bit here and there, some strange comments that he says and then immediately regrets because he's the robot boy. And now, in hindsight, I've experienced that because now, since the show goes, we go up to Silicon Valley, we meet the players within. I had those experiences where like, you people are kind of robots and you'll just say whatever and there's no filter, there's no humility. They'll in the first 5 minutes, they'll tell you what they've accomplished for sure.
Really?
Oh yeah, and that's fine, as you should. You personally own $500 million, whatever.
But anyway, yeah, just I was trying to just look for those little moments because starting with it, and even now, going into the fourth season in the fall, I want to make sure that Richard, who is pretty much the straight man, isn't void of all comedy or character or weirdness.
Well, what is the official definition of a straight man, and are there variations, or when you read the script, were you like, oh, this is classic straight man?
It could be perceived as that, I think, when maybe you first read the script, but I would never do that. I'm usually the guy that's brought on as like, there's Mike, there's
Punch
Dave, there's
the
Jamie,
humor.
And there's the bongler. Like, I'm Boner in Growing Pains, usually.
Right,
like in
all my, or Dupes.
Dupes, I'm Dupes, right? That's all my stuff. So I was actually really happy to be like the straight man and stuff like that. And so there is a bit of, and I don't like to say these words because it's so silly. When you're a comedian who your whole life is spent making fun of stuff, when you act earnest, it's really uncomfortable.
Because you know that you deserve
whatever. Because I should be made fun of, what I'm about to say. But like, there's a bit of acting going on. Like, there's a bit of kind of like, okay, like this moment has to be real without joke, sad or whatever.
No, for sure.
And I like that as like, it's definitely made me, or at least I feel like I'm better at that kind of stuff. I look at the show as pretty fortunate. I mean, this is gonna sound like my claws are coming out, and I'm like getting people, and I'm not meaning to. It's just weird how in entertainment, and especially in television, especially in movies, somehow in comedy, comedians don't get hired. Like people who do comedy professionally, they don't end up being on screen. And that's fine because occasionally you get really pleasantly surprised where, you know, some very notoriously straight actor or dramatic actor does something comedic and they're absolutely hilarious, right? But a lot of the time it's like an actor who's willing to say the cheesy line, has some timing, and then there you go. And
right.
They're cast.
And they're a comedic actor.
And they're a comedic actor. And I don't want to like sounds so like pissy, but it's just like this. I just look at this show. Let's talk about this one, I guess. It's like this is very fortunate that like Zach again. I've known for a long time. Like Zach, Camille, TJ, myself, even Martin to a degree. We all are active in the comedy world,
right?
And that's like kind of that's not commonplace.
Yeah, no, I guess when you think about it, it's not commonplace at all.
At least in terms of like performing live and getting out there and like making sure you're sharp. Like that's not really a thing that happens a lot. When we're filming, probably the writers get frustrated at us because we're always trying to like put in our jokes because we got to put our stamp on everything. And so they're always kind of like, hey man, just say the words that we spent 6 months writing, please.
Because they're going somewhere and they...
Yeah, and it's also, it's kind of like, it's completely arrogant. Like they spent so long crafting the script and we're like, yeah, okay, cool. we're going to make up our own joke.
Well, that brings up a question about the opposite of that, which is, when you get a bunch of comedians in a room and they're asked to do drama, do you have the same thing where all of a sudden, oh my God, you had no idea this person had it in them? And
I think that happens all the time. I think some of my favorite performances by comedians have been when they're dramatic. I mean, like Adam Sandler in Punch-Drunk Love, Jim Carrey in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
But I would think that's the silver lining of the show, is that it probably went more dramatic than anyone envisioned it at first. And the stakes probably got a lot higher. I think the joy for me on that show is that, I'm enormously entertained, but I'm also really invested in the success of you guys.
I get what you mean. I mean, honestly, I watch the show.
Not your personal success. I mean your character.
It's engaging, my personal success.
Yes.
No, but I get it. I watch the show as well, and I kind of feel that way, because especially so much time happens between shooting it and seeing it. I don't know what it looks like. I get to see it. So I'm also a fan.
When you watch the show, are you hard on yourself? Like, what's the dialogue in your head when you're watching the show?
It's a lot of critique. I do try and allow myself, like, if there's something that I like that I've done, I go, good, that was funny. Well done, Tom. But a lot of the times I'm like, ugh. I rarely laugh at the show because I'm just sort of, like, analyzing it.
Really?
Yeah. But I have laughed.
Are you hard on yourself?
Yes. I'm essentially, anything I see, I'm looking at stuff that's, like, probably wrong with it.
And do you think that helps you in the long run, like being hard on yourself?
I don't know. I'm not professional enough of an actor to like take a workshop or a class or get taught anything, because I always find that gets me in my head and I get worse. But so this is I better learn from something. I don't know.
I mean, it brings up a question, because some actors will say, I never want to watch dailies because I don't want to like get in my own head about, and other people will watch them religiously and learn from what they're doing.
Well, I think it's even, I think it's a lot, you can learn from it on the sense of choices that you make and like really actory stuff, but I also think you can learn very technical things. Like when you're, like, when you think you're being really small and acting really small and you see yourself and you're like, oh, I was really big there. I was really broad.
Learning to modulate your tone.
Learning to modulate. Learn to like, when you think, and I've had that happen so many times where the director's like trying to either get more or less from me and I'm doing the opposite. So I'm like, what do they know? And then I see it. I'm like, oh, they were totally right.
And you keep relearning that lesson over and over.
Yes, exactly.
Well, listen, I think you're in a great place because you do have opportunity. You're doing great work that is different, and it's, you know, it is that beautiful mix of there's depth and there's comedy and there's drama and there's dark sadness.
Yeah.
You know, I think you're in a great position, and I also feel like you're just at the beginning of being able to do so much stuff. So I'm a big fan, and I'm
here's hoping. I mean, I'm trying. The weird thing, you know, we've had this discussion about like drama and comedy and the two masks of catharsis, the two Grecian masks. But I've thought about all that kind of stuff, and man, as much as I love doing comedy, and I always do comedy, especially live stuff, like the more and more I either get confidence or even the ability to be considered for more dramatic stuff, the more and more I want it. Because like when I go to the movies, especially the movies, TV is a bit different, but whenever I go to films, I rarely get excited about comedies. For some reason in America, the agreed upon sense of humor is like frat boys stuff.
Right.
Parties,
it's
drinking. Old school times a million, like every trailer is like, it's like all just nonsense. And Zac Efron is the lead, but like I don't get it. Like it's just not for me. So for some reason, I'm like I guess I don't understand comedy, or maybe like I don't understand the majority of sense of humor of Americans. But I do still watch serious stuff. I love horror. Did you see Green Room?
Yes.
I mean, it's fucking incredible.
Terrifying and dark and just...
And well acted, these young ones.
Yeah.
Imogen. Mm. Poots. Hi. Shiver me timbers.
Listen, she was sitting right there 1 week ago. Jeez.
You'll cut that away. No. I'm married. No, but that movie and like, there's just all kinds of stuff. I mean, I'm maybe not... But yeah, there's a lot of things and you know, given the opportunity... I'd love to go down those roads.
Yeah, well, listen, I look forward to whatever you do because I think you're really a very watchable, interesting human. And it's been a treat for me to get to know all the crazy internet stuff that's out there of you. You
know, I know. I got to like start taking some things down.
Don't do it. I mean, you know, pooping while your dog yells at you.
That is good.
I mean, that's sort of like the epitome of your that generational thing we talked about.
Yes,
that
exactly.
You can put just about anything up there. And just about all of it is really entertaining. So
cool.
Thanks for coming and doing this.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that's our show for today, folks. Thanks as always for tuning in, and be sure to join me next time when I sit down with Luke Wilson, a guy I think is one of the most natural actors around.
When we first came to town, my brothers and Wes, we were in this building over on the Sony lot where Cameron was working with James L. Brooks, who was helping us along with Bottle Rocket. But it was one of those things I thought, just in this one building, James L. Brooks and Cameron Crowe, this Hollywood's going to be great.
We discuss his close creative relationship with his brothers and director Wes Anderson, and his transition to more dramatic roles in Meadowland and Cameron Crowe's new series, Roadies. That and why he'll probably never get in another elevator with Gene Hackman. See you next time, off camera.